The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. There is an America that votes and an America that doesn't or can't vote. In 2014, the America that voted was 142 million registered, 97 million not. Two Americas. Why there are two Americas varies from person to person and state to state, and the rules for voting in each of those places. People in the state of Kansas implemented the SAFE Act, the Secure and Fair Elections Act, in 2013. The law was sponsored by Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, requires that persons registering to vote in Kansas must provide U.S. proof of citizenship when registering. Kansas is just one of four states that have this requirement for voter registration, along with Alabama, Arizona, and Georgia. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, only Kansas and Arizona are enforcing the law. Between now and the election of 2016, The Takeaway will be taking a look at the two Americas, where you can and where you can't vote, and why. Kansas has gone one step further in its proof of citizenship restriction. If you are in the process of registering to vote, but have not completed that process, whether because of failure to provide proof of citizenship or whatever, you have 90 days to complete the Kansas requirements or you will be bumped from the list. That means people will actually go into the list and cross your name off, added to the roll of incomplete registrants, and forced to register again. 36,000 people in Kansas who tried to register to vote since 2013 have been unsuccessful in completing the process. Kris Kobach is Kansas Secretary of State since January of 2011. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you.
Is there anything you can tell me about those 36,000 people?
So we're talking about individuals who have started the registration process. And when we say that, we mean they've filled out a small card. You know, they've written the five lines on the card, name, address, et cetera. And most of them haven't proven their citizenship. Some haven't signed the card, which is something that existed long before our new law. Some left a line blank or something like that. But one of the things we started doing with the new law is we required our county clerks to constantly contact these people, remind them, hey, you still have to prove your citizenship. Don't forget. And we are finding that with our society being so mobile, about 34% of the people on this list of incomplete registrants have already moved away. They had a residence at one point. They've moved somewhere else in Kansas or they've left the state entirely. We're realizing that it's impractical to leave people on an incomplete list indefinitely. And then one other thing I'd remind you, it's not as if you fail to complete it within 90 days, you're out of luck. All you have to do is fill out the card again. It takes less than 60 seconds.
Although that is an impediment to voting, right?
I don't think so. No, I don't think filling out a form is an impediment to voting. If that's an impediment to voting, then John, I'd argue that getting in a car and driving to the polling place is an impediment to voting. I'd rather fill out a card and take 30 seconds to do it than hop in my car and drive 5 minutes.
What is the most important thing to you as a Secretary of State in Kansas, that the most people vote in the state, that there's the highest turnout of eligible voters in the state of Kansas, or are you most concerned about voter fraud in the state of Kansas?
Well, it's both. I mean, the way I look at it is in any state, it should be easy to vote, but hard to cheat. And I think we've accomplished that here. We've really made it quite easy to comply with our proof of citizenship requirement. And the proof of citizenship requirement is necessitated because in most of the other states, in 46 states, all you do is sign your name. And it's a system based completely on trust. No one ever checks. And we've discovered many, many cases of aliens getting on our voter rolls either intentionally as part of usually they don't even know they're breaking the law. Someone tells them to do this, or unintentionally. They go to get their driver's license if they're in the United States legally. And the nice lady at the counter at the end of the interview says, hey, would you like to register to vote? And the non-citizen thinks, oh, this person is from the government. I guess I can register to vote and vote. So our system is fraught with mistakes like that being made. And every time an alien votes, it effectively cancels out the vote of a United States citizen. And we have lots of close elections. And when that happens, you're talking about the potential to throw the election.
Has an election ever been thrown in Kansas because of fraud like this? And you said many, many, many aliens, and you weren't talking about Kansas. You were just sort of saying around the country.
It's hard to know for sure, but we have many elections that have come down to one vote. But I'll give you one that was extensively investigated just across the state line in North Kansas City, Missouri. That was the Rizzo versus Royster primary for the state legislature, where there were multiple allegations of Somali nationals voting and other individuals who weren't legally in the district voting. And even the Kansas City Star ultimately conceded after all kinds of depositions were taken and that election had been stolen. And it was estimated that approximately 50 non-citizens voted in it. We have a case in Kansas where a large number.
Is it an interesting, though, that the state of Missouri didn't go to your proof of citizenship restriction on voting, even though there was that election?
Well, no, but it's not as simple as that. So Missouri has attempted to go to photo ID, and then usually the next step after photo ID for a state is proof of citizenship. But they've got a battle over that between the legislature, which is Republican, and the governor, who's a Democrat. And then also they have a state Supreme Court that has argued that a provision in their state constitution would require a constitutional amendment. So they are trying to move in that direction, at least the legislature is. But then you also asked about, you know, the number of the threat of non-citizens on our voter rolls. You know, can we substantiate it? And yes, we can. You can't look at any state's voter rolls and just say, oh, there's a citizen, there's an alien. There's no indicator that tells you that. And you can't look at last names. You can't, you know, derive it from some other data point. But you do find it from time to time when an individual concedes, yes, I'm on the voter rolls, I'm not a U.S. citizen. In Kansas, we have discovered over 30 cases just in the last few years of non-citizens who either got on our voter rolls before the law went into effect or who attempted to register after our law went into effect but were successfully stopped when they were asked for proof of citizenship. Someone called them from the county clerk's office and they conceded on the telephone, oh, I'm not even a U.S. citizen. I didn't know I couldn't register.
Although 30 cases weighed against 36,000 people potentially bumped from the rolls seems like an imbalance to me.
Well, but remember, those 36,000 are not facing any barrier. Many of them have no intention, and we know this because, again, from conversations with the county clerk, they're saying to the clerk, well, you know, would you please stop calling me? I don't really want to register. Others have left the jurisdiction, about 34%. We've done some samples of the body of individuals. And any one of them can register from their couch. All they have to do is take a passport or a birth certificate or what it's about a dozen documents, take a picture of it with their smartphone and email it in, fax it in. They can send a copy in or bring it in if they want to. There are four different ways to. And some counties even allow texting of it in. So it's not as if they're facing any real barrier to completing the registration process.
Chris Kobach is Kansas Secretary of State since January of 2011. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Part of the dysfunction, and I suppose that could be argued in America's democracy, is how Democrats have national majorities on many of their core issues. While 70% of state legislatures, more than 60% of governors, 55% of attorneys general and secretaries of state are in Republican hands. Angela Rye, Democratic strategist and principal CEO of Impact Strategies, is here in the studio. Angela, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And this is a long trend where we have seen the Democratic Party good at the kind of national election chasing this kind of demographic change, and the Republican Party doing something fundamentally different at the local level. First of all, what do you see happening at the local level that gives the Republicans such an advantage?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is I think that Republicans have always, or I won't say always, have traditionally been a better messaging machine. They know how to ensure that their messages resonate on the ground level. And it's so interesting because every presidential, well, at least for some time now, Democrats have demonstrated that they have the upper hand in ground game. And I wonder now how much of that will shift given kind of this ever-strengthening partnership with the Koch brothers and the Republican Party, if that changes at all. But I would definitely argue it's all in the message. And Democrats, I think, whether we're talking about at the federal level where there are candidate recruitment efforts or even on the state and local level where recruitment efforts kind of subside, we focus way too much on the candidate and not the message that's resonating with, as you talked about, the rising American electorate or the demographic shift. So if you don't ever have someone who's speaking to the core of someone's issues in a local community, what is going to drive them to the polls? Mm-hmm. And I think Republicans have mastered that and we have not.
And, you know, Rick Hertzberg at The New Yorker wrote about this, describing the debate and the Republican and Democratic debate. And really, if you listen to the rhetoric there, it's two different nations. Mm-hmm. In the Republican nation, it is everything's falling apart.
Yeah.
Things are completely destroyed. and socialism is ruining America. And so you can reach angry voters who believe that is the case at the local level and mobilize them, whereas the Democratic message is we're doing fine, let's kind of stay the course. Bernie Sanders is, of course, saying we need to change the income disparity. But still, it seems as though angry voters are more easily mobilized as local voters.
I think that's 100% right. I wonder what would happen if, again, we place less emphasis on the candidate. So one thing, I've been in this kind of ideological war with people about Barack Obama even. My argument is that Barack Obama is not just the candidate. He actually is the issue. And by issue, I don't mean problem. I mean he represented a historical paradigm shift for this country. He represented, a legacy, with full of hatred and racism and slavery, changing to something more promising and hopeful. And I think that's an issue. It demonstrates progressive shift. It means that we are finally evolving, and that to me means he is an issue. And that's why I think we're having some challenges with this current slate of candidates.
Because when he walks out the door, there goes the issue.
That's right. And what you see in recent polls is that people 50 and under in the Democratic Party are overwhelmingly still not satisfied with the current slate of candidates. So that, that's a huge gap to fill. And I think that doesn't just exist in local elections. It also could exist for us now with this 2016 election coming up.
Has Barack Obama changed the way people are presidential? Is he presidential in a fundamentally different way? I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day, and this is the first presidency since Eisenhower that has not ended with some sort of special prosecutor impeachment, investigation, assassination.
They would
something
try.
Like that.
I mean, yeah. Not assassination, but they would try on the impeachment. I mean, they've said that for some time, and it just hasn't caught traction. And of course, that they voted to repeal Obamacare over 50 times, took it to the Supreme Court. So there were scandal attempts or challenges to undo his legacy that were attempted that just didn't stick. The one thing that is also really interesting to me is that this idea of a lame duck presidency has completely changed. They're going full force through the end of this term like no one has ever seen. And I think that is also very, very interesting and changes our expectations. But watching this election process for 2016 is also very different. We certainly didn't see this in 2008 or 2012.
You know, states are responsible for the voting rules.
Yes.
States are responsible for, election practices, that sort of thing. States and localities support education. These are really important touch points for voters getting involved in politics. And these are the stakes that the local voters really hold dear. Why can't Democrats have more of an impact there in school board elections, in the mayoral elections?
I think it's about ensuring that people understand the important role that state and local politics play on your everyday life or in your everyday life. You talked about they touch voting. The thing that immediately comes to mind is what happened in Alabama. The state legislature passed a voter suppression law. We call it voter suppression because it would shrink the ability to vote. It would shrink the electorate and have the worst impact on communities of color. Well, after they passed this suppressive measure in Alabama, they then closed licensing offices in districts or in areas that were overwhelmingly black. The overwhelmingly black areas vote Democratic in Alabama. So this is all the kinds of things that happen if we're not paying attention. We can't afford to just pay attention to what happens on the federal level because, yes, taxes happen on the state level and local level. We talked about voting policies. Redistricting, of course, happens. That'll be in 2020. But we can't afford to wait to 2020 to start paying attention to who's representing our interests. And by our, I mean Americans on the local level.
And if gun control could win a statewide election, that would change things. But the way this is configured, there's no way that can happen.
Well, I think that we have to pay attention to where there have been some gains. I know that Democrats picked up 9 state houses since 2012. And so things can change, but it's not just about a pickup. It's about ensuring that you're electing a candidate that represents your interest, whatever your interest might be, and ensuring that, you know, my vote matters, not just when it's a presidential every 4 years. It matters every single time there's an election day in November and I need to go, or a primary. Mm-hmm. It's very important for people to stay engaged.
Angela Rise, Democratic strategist and principal and CEO of Impact Strategies. Thanks so much, Angela.
Thank you.
We'll be talking to you again before 2016, that's for sure.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
One of the problems faced by junior colleges and community colleges is the challenge of dealing with the estimated 60% of community college students who are in need of what's called remediation. They need to get up to speed with high school skills. And this has become a real problem for junior colleges, some which have become dumping grounds for remedial students, or at least that's how they describe themselves. The City University of New York's community colleges are a unique collection of institutions, and nearly 80% of their students need remediation. But what sets CUNY apart from other colleges? Beth Fertig is a contributing editor for education at WNYC. Welcome, Beth.
Hello.
The sitcom Community has a great line in it which says, I had to go back to school to get a real degree.
Yeah.
And describe the community's college world as America.
Right.
It's the real world.
It is. It is. And at CUNY, as you mentioned, 80% of the students need at least one remedial class because they barely got through graduation in high school or they needed a GED. And so they are required to take remedial classes in order to become ready for college. But CUNY has a lot of different programs to help them when they need remedial programs. This one that I was studying and reporting on called START is a very unusual program because it takes the ones who need at least 2 remedial classes in math, English, or writing, and it delays their enrollment so they don't have to spend their money. They can just spend 1 semester and focus on passing those classes.
They would be using their financial aid or paying out of pocket for those classes. They may fail a class and have to take it a second time. So this could become a very expensive endeavor for a student.
Now, that's the dean in charge of CUNY's START program, Donna Linderman. And that really deals with one of the real disincentives for kids to enter because they feel like they're going to be spending so much money on remediation that they why bother to go to
community college? Or worse, they just do it thinking that they can pass as they're taking their regular classes, and then they drop out. And so for $75, this program allows them to take their remedial classes over an intensive period. They're going either full-time or part-time. And then what's been really dramatic is it's shown that in the few years that it's been happening, based on preliminary studies, 51% of the students who enrolled have no need for remedial classes at the end, which means they can start college fresh, pay their tuition, use their tuition assistance without having to take remedial classes. And another 30% passed at least one. So they're still starting better off than if they hadn't gone through this and used their aid.
And here's one of the students who really testifies to the follow-through on the part of CUNY.
They had my back 24/7. No matter where I go through, no matter how stressed I am, no matter how tired I am, no matter how hungry I am, but they just helped me a whole lot. And then that's why I'm able to pass my writing and my math, and I thank God for that.
This is a huge degree of catch-up that CUNY has managed to figure out with this program. How quickly are they able to accomplish this?
Well, it's one semester that they're able to get through this if they can, and more than half are doing it. That was Jimmy Arzu, who had tried college once before, and he flunked out. So he's saying this is different. They had my back. And what he means is this program is very unusual. CUNY developed its own curriculum, hired its own faculty, gives them advisors. That's something that cannot be replicated, though, in a lot of other states, as I discovered, because it's so expensive. New York has a special program to reimburse colleges for students who are continuing education students like this. It's about $2,100 per student. A lot of states don't have that. So spreading this is going to be a big lift nationally, even though it looks very promising.
But it's a serious issue because ostensibly families have paid taxes to have these high school skills given to their children, and they're going to be paying it again when the kids go to college. New York has an innovative program. Beth, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Beth Fertig is contributing editor for education at WNYC.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like decluttering, drone photography, and duct tape crafting. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
When artist Mira Bartok remembers her late mother, it's sometimes hard for her to know which mother to speak about.
She could draw a map and label all the countries and their capitals in several languages from just sitting down. And I mean, she really had these kind of savant, like creative, brilliant explosions of something that I never saw that when she was medicated.
Mira Bartok's mother had schizophrenia, a disturbing disease. The symptoms of confusion, paranoia, and delusions are wrapped around an often creative personality, rendered unreachable, as Mira alluded to there, by traditional drug therapies. Well, a new study funded by the National Institute of Mental Health and published this week in the American Journal of Psychiatry concludes that less medication and more talk therapy is, in fact, a better method of treatment. Richard A. Friedman is a professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College in Manhattan. He's long warned against the overuse of prescription drugs for mental health patients. Dr. Friedman is here with Mira Bartok, an artist, illustrator, and the author of The Memory Palace, a best-selling memoir about Mira's mother's schizophrenia. Her mother's story is a mystery, like the disease itself.
She was a rather extreme case, and she was delusional most of the time. She fluctuated between very flat affect and, you know, being almost like a catatonic zombie sometimes. There was a cycle. She would go into these kind of paranoiac rages. Gosh, those are the things that really stick in my mind, the complete flat affect and being really out of it and not aware of her surroundings much, and then going into these delusional rages. And she heard voices all the time. They didn't stop until like a couple hours before her death or the day before she died.
Was there a mother in there, a personality in there that you understood, even a tiny piece of one?
Oh, absolutely. Before she, you know, mental illness hijacked her brain, I know that she must have been a very vivacious, kind and loving person. And she was really an incredibly gifted musician. You know, she definitely would have gone on to perform, and she loved art, and those above everything else. I think those are the things that actually calm the voices. After she died, I read her last 17 years of her life. She kept these diaries. And throughout all those diaries, a large part of them were really delusional, but there were all these other things that she wrote in there that were very loving about her children and also just incredibly creative. I mean, she just had a brilliant mind. So there was definitely this amazing person underneath that was destroyed, you know, so much by mental illness, but it did shine through.
Mira Bartok is an artist and illustrator and author of The Memory Palace, a memoir about her schizophrenic mother. Richard Friedman, who's a professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College in Manhattan, that is typical to have a set of symptoms that are this outer shell of schizophrenia that are very difficult to penetrate or tolerate. But yet there is an intact and lucid personality within the individual.
Sure. I mean, what's typical of schizophrenia are a group of psychotic symptoms, like Mira just described vividly, you know, hallucinations, hearing voices, having false beliefs, these delusions, feeling that people want to hurt you or kill you. And those are the so-called positive symptoms that the antipsychotic drugs are generally pretty good at treating. But what they're not very good at treating are what we call the negative symptoms, which are the social withdrawal, the cognitive problems in schizophrenia, the lack of socialized, you know, interactions, all of those other things, poor social functioning, that the drugs are not very good at treating.
And so talk therapy, the more traditional one-on-one, very labor-intensive talk therapy, reaches in and tries to invigorate this personality within the paranoid symptoms and re-engage them.
Right. That's what's so striking about this new study, showing that, you know, what used to be thought of as just simply a brain disease, all you need to do is give somebody with schizophrenia a drug, and if you take away their psychotic symptoms, boom, magic. You know, if you remove this sickness, the person inside, like Mira's mother, who's this classically trained pianist, will just emerge without any special help whatsoever. And actually what this study shows is that if you go and target those social problems and those psychological problems and those family problems that people have, they actually get better.
Hmm. Did you ever attempt talk therapy with your mother, Mira?
You know, we were welfare kids. And so, and I left home when I was 17. And my mother was on, you know, federal assistance. And so all that in Ohio, all that they would pay for were, I think, you know, maybe a handful of visits to a psychiatrist who dispensed medication. So she never got talk therapy. Although what she did get for a period of time in the 70s until Reagan came to office and these programs were cut in 1980, she did get some group therapy help at a community center for the mentally ill, which was fantastic. To be honest with you, her very first experience with a doctor was really terrible. She was sexually assaulted, and that was in the dark ages of psychiatry. I don't know if she ever would have trusted a doctor. I think the most effective way of calming the voices, and I saw, you know, I witnessed this as well as read about in her diaries, would be any kind of activity like playing music, drawing, anything like that that was meditative, because you are completely in the moment. And the problem with the medication, they just made her not able to do those things.
Dr. Friedman, is there an intervention that is suggested here by Mira's story and others before we go?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, the experience that Mira had with her mother suggests that we need to do much more than just give somebody a medicine. You have to intervene at the level of the person.
And early,
exactly. The earlier you do it, the longer you wait for this disease to take hold and have its effect in the brain, the much harder it is to have a good outcome.
Richard Friedman is professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College in Manhattan. Mira Bartok is an artist, illustrator, and the author of The Memory Palace, a memoir. It's about her schizophrenic mother. Mira and Richard, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.